Hi, this is Mimi, and welcome to my podcast, The Lovely Becoming. Today's guest is Hattie J. Lee, who is a licensed marriage and family therapist based in Los Angeles. I'm so excited to have you on. Hi, Hattie.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Tell us about yourself. What do you do? What do you love?
Well, I am a licensed marriage and family therapist, and I have a group practice out in Los Angeles, California. And I absolutely love being a therapist. I work primarily with a lot of creatives, empaths, couples, entrepreneurs, Asian Americans, all these wonderful folks. And a lot of my work focuses on intergenerational trauma, family of origin relationships, and a lot of identity work, helping people to really be their true selves. And it's been really rewarding work for me.
Wow, I'd love to hear that. Hattie and I connected through Instagram, as with most of my guests on here, and I absolutely adore her work. She speaks so eloquently on topics like trauma, relationships, and mental health in general. Can you give us a working definition of trauma, just jumping right in?
Sure. I think a lot of people, when they think of trauma, they often think of what I refer to as big T trauma, right? Being a victim of war, a refugee, or being in a natural disaster or some sort of traumatic abuse or violence, right, that leads to post-traumatic stress disorder, right? So very outright disturbing things. But I have a much more expansive view of trauma that includes what I would refer to as little T trauma, right, which is literally any event or experience that basically overwhelms our body and our nervous system's ability to cope the stress, that leaves imprints, and it stays stuck inside of our bodies because we don't know how to deal with it. So trauma is not, it's much less about the event or what happened, but more about our reaction or experience of the event. And I find that a lot of times it's not always about what happened, but also it can also be about what doesn't happen, like, you know, the kind of support that we have after a traumatic event, right? Or how we experience the situation when something happens. And so, sometimes the absence of some needed experience that we had that we don't get, that can actually be very traumatic on our system. I don't know if that is clear.
Yeah, that's perfect. I really appreciate that you talk about the absence of certain things in our lives that can be traumatic for us because we need nurturing and care and reciprocal relationships and things like that. And when those are missing, that can be traumatic too. Tell me a little bit about the distinction between little T and big T trauma, what you think about that and how it might serve to, you know, invite people into naming their experiences or to minimize their experiences with the distinction.
You can have two people experience a big T trauma, and, there might be someone who might be, doing okay, and then you might have somebody who is, feeling very debilitated by it. They might experience it like, usually, we focus a lot on the sensation, right? Like our body sensations, right? Some people will feel it in the body, right? Which is what we usually feel when we experience something. There might be tension, there might be tightness. We might feel it in our throats or our gut. And then we have this whole story and narrative around what we're telling ourselves about what happened. Looking at that, people's experiences can be so different. But I do feel like a big piece of assessing, like, oh, is this, is this trauma or not, is by, asking what is your actual experience of it. And I think being able to differentiate, because I don't want to, make trauma just like everything is traumatic, right? We don't want to reduce it to that. But I think, just living in our society, that there is a level of trauma to it, right? We're experiencing just a very imperfect culture and a toxic culture as well. And there's something traumatic about that as well. And I think it's important to have that more expansive view of it. I think being able to differentiate those two is really important, because a lot of times people dismiss their own experiences because they think, oh, my experience wasn't that bad, right? I hear that all the time. It's not that bad, right? My parents really weren't there, but I didn't almost die, right? Like people compare it to something so extreme, and that tells you a lot about what we expect about our lives. And I think it's important to acknowledge that, hey, just because you didn't experience something outright disturbing doesn't mean that, you can't be having a really hard experience, with just everyday life. And so I think that piece is really important to differentiate.
Yeah, that's really incredibly important. And I think like we can almost lower the bar of like at least it wasn't that bad, and at least like the bare minimum, when we should be really aiming a little bit higher than that, I think.
Yes. Life is much more than, of that.
Thinking about intergenerational trauma, how is it that the trauma of our ancestors is passed down to future generations, and how do we grow awareness and respond to the disproportionate effects of it?
I think when I think about intergenerational trauma, I work with that a lot in my work. Especially because I work with a lot of children of immigrants in my practice, and there's a lot of different ways, and I think the most common ways that we often know about intergenerational trauma is how it is transmitted through our relationships and through attachment, right? So what I mean by that is, for example, like our parents' experience or relational attachment with their parents, right? They can actually pass on that dynamic and learn those relational skills, or not learn, and actually relate with us in very similar ways that can feel very painful and damaging to us, right? So trauma can be, passed down relationally. But I think more of the latest research, what it's telling us is showing us is that they actually found that trauma can be passed down genetically. And so I think this has been a very profound finding in the research, because they found that there's a gene that passes through up to three generations. So that's grandparents, so my grandparents, right? Their genes passed down, right, to my parents and then to me. And it's not that it's changing the code of the gene, but they're finding that it changes the way that the gene expresses itself, right? So, for example, my grandparents, they lived, they were colonized by the Japanese. My parents, I'm Korean, and so so they literally experienced something like a big T trauma of being colonized and experiencing very frightening and terrorizing experiences in their lives. And what happens with the genes is that the genes, we're creatures that know. I mean, we know how to survive, and what happens to their genes is that it starts adapting, right? So it starts adapting to the environment, which is, for my grandparents, that it's really unsafe. You should not trust strangers. And I imagine and assume that they were very hyper alert, right? They're very cautious and careful, and the genes can actually express itself through our body sensations, our behaviors, and all of that. And they're finding that that can get passed down, right? So that happens to my grandparents, and then when that gene gets passed down to my parents, what happens is that that gene is going to be much more likely to express itself in similar ways, even if the environment might be different. And so, for my parents, they were immigrants, and so they actually experienced trauma of immigration. And so in a lot of ways, I think just as I look back, I think that gene that got passed down, it was very adaptive even for my parents, because it probably helped them survive immigration. And it kept, you know, they were hyper alert, you know, they were very cautious and distrusting of strangers and, you know, things like that. So I did get to see some of those similar themes, but imagine that gene passing on to me, right? Where I live a much more, I would say, you know, not a much more stable life, right? than my parents had and my grandparents had. Like, if I were to carry that hyper alertness or that fear of strangers, or just feeling really easily, I guess maybe even sensitive to my environment, right? Or just all the little change, noticing all the changes that's going on, being really self-conscious, right? All of that, that can actually have a very debilitating effect on me. Especially if my environment does not require it. and so, you know, so that's kind of how, I don't know if that makes it very clear, but that's kind of how they're seeing that the gene can get passed down, and then that the expression of it can, you know, show up to three generations. And a lot of it was focused on Holocaust. You know, they did a lot of the studies with Holocaust survivors, which is, you know, what they discover, how they discovered it.
That's really interesting. And I think I'm really grateful that you brought in the genetic piece and the environmental factor of relationships and attachment, because I think sometimes we focus on one or the other, right. But it's really a blend of both and can have really magnificent effects.
Yeah, it really can. And I think a lot of times I get a lot of people's, you know, saying like, I don't know why I'm like this, right? I hear that a lot. I don't know why I'm, I mean, some people, they're like, oh, I know why I'm like this because X, Y, and Z, you know? Mm-hmm. And then I had a group of people where they're like, I don't know why I'm like this. Why am I just like this? Right?
Yeah.
Like, there's no reason for me to be like this. And I think when people say that, my brain is like, huh, you know, I wonder, you know, if there might be any sort of intergenerational trauma, you know, it just kind of like puts a little question mark for me, and we do explore it. And more often than not, I mean, I would say almost every time there has definitely been intergenerational trauma, you know, that they not only witnessed it relationally, but, you know, I just imagine just genetically, they were naturally inclined to experience the world in the way that they do. I think that's really helpful to acknowledge and know, because a lot of times we can feel like something's wrong with us. Like, why is my body reacting this way? Nobody else reacts this way. You know, we have this really unhelpful conversation in our minds. But I think being able to give it a name and to identify where it might be coming from can actually be really freeing. And so I think that's something to consider if, you know, whenever we're having an experience that is overwhelming.
Yeah. And I think it's really hard when we can't pinpoint the instance that's causing our reactions and emotions. Right. And so that's really important to have that to explore as well.
Right.
Wow. what does it mean to change the narratives we've been taught to believe about ourselves?
Well, I guess it's important to first identify what the narratives are, right? And, you know, when we talk about narratives, we're talking about, you know, what are the stories that we tell ourselves in our mind, right? About who we are and about how safe our world is, and how we are to experience and live our lives. And I think a lot of times in this work of, not just in therapy, but just this work of healing and just this work of, you know, becoming embodied in our whole selves, right? We do have a lot of conversation about how do we change this narrative. And you know, I think a big piece is about change is really about unlearning a lot of the stories that we ended up creating, right? based on our lived experiences, because that was the best way we knew how to make sense of what we were going through. And really, you know, I'm thinking just even neurologically, our brains, it doesn't fully develop until we're well into our 20s, right? So can you imagine, you know, little 4-year-old, right? Little 4-year-old trying to navigate a really stressful or difficult situation or a confusing situation, right? And trying to make sense of it. And if, let's say, little 4-year-old girl does not have the support from a attuned parent, there is no way for that little 4-year-old to know, you know, to create a story that's going to be helpful. You know, if anything, that 4-year-old, I mean, we hear this all the time. I used to work with a lot of children before, but they have, you know, aren't we know what we know about the brain is that we have a tendency to focus on what's negative more than what's positive because of our survival instincts, right? And a lot of times when something happens, kids will often blame themselves. They will often think that, oh, it's because of them, right? Or something's wrong with them. Or, you know, they have this really, a much more negative perception of what happened in their world. And, you know, and I, you know, that, and I think at that time it helps them to cope and survive, you know, with whatever they're going through. But I think a lot of times we grow up and we carry those same narratives into adulthood, well into adulthood. Even when our context has changed, right? So even when maybe the situation we're in might not be as, you know, it might actually be safer, you know, or it might actually, you know, we might be in relationships with people who really want to love us and who care about us, right? But if we have a history of not experiencing that, we can bring that in, those same stories of like not being able to trust other people into adulthood. And it could really be very damaging in the way that we experience our world. And so a big piece is really changing, you know, how can we you know, put this narrative that we experience right now in the correct time in history. And how do we create a much more accurate story of what's happening in the present moment, you know, based on what we're experiencing, based on what our body is telling us through our physical sensations, right? Our emotions, all of that, right? And so be really learning how to be present to know like what's the actual truth here about who I am. You know, not what I used to feel or believe about myself, but who I truly am, and what's really the truth about, you know, relationships, about other people or this world that's going to be really supportive for me as I navigate this life. And so, yeah, and you know, and I think a big piece that I feel like that I come across a lot with a lot of my clients is that you know, they sometimes they don't even know what that new narrative should be. Right, they don't know. Like, okay, if that's not the narrative, right, and I should change it. What do I change it to? Right, I think a lot of people they have no idea, and I think some very big ones is, you know, just even our sense of self, right? Knowing that we are worthy, that we are lovable, that we are good enough, that we deserve to be seen, that we deserve to take up space, and we deserve to be fully known. You know, those are truths that I think get missed a lot for a lot of folks. And when we believe in those truths, we're able to actually care for ourselves and make decisions and show up in a way that aligns with those truths, rather than the alternative. And so, you know, changing that narrative is about really reclaiming those truths, you know, of what we would tell the younger version of ourselves, right? If we knew what we knew now, and being able to live our lives in a way that matches that.
Yeah, I think that's really important. And I think our bodies are really, really smart, but I don't know that we're always connected to our brains and our minds in the sense that, you know, we're not really able to, I feel like we have to consciously connect the dots between mind and body in terms of like reminding ourselves of truths and reminding ourselves to be in the present moment, and that those coping mechanisms that were so useful as children don't have to be the same environment that we're in now.
Right.
The wheels are turning. Oh my goodness. Speaking of attachment a little bit, we learn how to relate to others from our caregivers at an early age. How do our childhood attachments shape our relationships as adults? And how do we heal from negative relationships with our parents if that's all we know?
Yeah, that's a really big one. I'm like, wow,
Yes.
where we even begin? So I think the first one was, how do our childhood attachments shape our relationships, right? And I think I briefly mentioned, but we basically learn everything we know through relationships, right? And through how we connect with other people in our world, right? And especially our first relationships, whoever that may be, it, you know, more often than not, it is our, you know, our caregivers or family or, you know, whoever it is, or, and, you know, they have the most profound impact on us, right? And, you know, just kind of how our caregivers or these adult relationships or parents actually attune and care for us when we're even when we're infants, right? We learn about the world. So we learn about what the world is like through our first relationships. We learn how, you know, what to expect, how we, ex you know, what the experience is like. And then we basically it sets a blueprint for how we see the world, right? So if we grew up in you know, with parents or caregivers who basically were very, you know, trustworthy, safe, and attuned to our needs and to our sense of self, then we grew up expecting almost, right, that the world is going to be like that. You know, that we just expect that this is right, and that this is how I'm supposed to be treated. That we grow up having a very strong sense of ourself, and knowing that we're worthy, and that our identity is not attached to our doing, right? But it's inherent to who we are, right? Because when we're children or infants, we're not doing much, right? We're just, you know, we're just eating, really living, we're trying to survive. And yet our, you know, our caregivers, they model for us that we still deserve care and attention, even though we're not offering anything, you know, or doing anything, or and so, you know, so that a relationship could really set us up for life, right? But on the other hand, if we grow up with caregivers who maybe you know, due to their own pain and their own trauma or unprocessed trauma or their own difficulties with their relationship with their own parents, right? It could affect the way they attach to us as infants. And that can really be frightening as a, you know, as you can imagine as a kid, if you're not, if you don't have a caregiver who is like attentive to what you actually need, or, you know, what you're trying to communicate, right? That's very frustrating when you're constantly feeling misunderstood, or you're wanting, you know, maybe you're hungry, but, you know, maybe the caregiver is just so busy and not attentive that they don't know you're hungry. So you get what I mean. So there could be a lot of miss. That if we experience that, then we grow up expecting that, oh, I guess that's just what life is, or that's what the world is. And we start adjusting our behaviors and even the stories we tell ourselves to match those experiences. Because our brains are habitual, right? You know, what we're learning, what we know and learn learning about the brain is that it loves to create habits, and it loves the familiar. And so it will always attach to what's most familiar, you know, even if maybe the environment might suggest otherwise. Yeah, so, you know, so we also learn about how we get our needs met, and you know, all of that. So it has just a huge, profound impact. Yes.
Yeah, I really liked what you said too about familiarity and attaching to that even when the environment changes. I think that's really interesting.
Yeah. It happens all the time.
Yeah, and you know, I think I read somewhere recently about kind of how there's kind of comfort in that safety of familiarity, and that's
Right.
part of the reason why sometimes we want to watch shows that we've seen before, or read books that we've already read, like for that sense of like comfort and familiarity.
Right. There's nothing unpredictable about it, right? And I think a lot of times we're afraid of what's not predictable. That can feel very unsafe.
And I think we don't know what our emotions are going to be or our response. And so it's nice to know,
Right.
like, I understand what's going to happen. I can anticipate how I'm going to feel. And that's a
Right,
really good feeling.
and it's I think neurologically it makes a lot of sense, but when you kind of apply that to real life, it's like even I mean we do that all the time, even as we're experiencing immense pain, right? We'd rather keep on doing what we're doing, even though it's so painful, because it's familiar, right? And it's a lot easier for our brains to access what's familiar than something completely new, even when we're suffering. And so, I think that's why it's so important to really practice presence and to be very intentional aware of what's going on, so we know how to nurture our needs in a very mindful way.
A lot of therapists use the term grief to describe response to loss, but what
Yeah.
does grieving really look like in practice?
Oh, it's hard. I will say that the thing I feel like we there's a I mean even right now, right, there is a collective grief that we are all dealing with. And our bodies and our brains, we and our culture, we have a tendency to want to avoid uncomfortable feelings, right? Grief, pain, loss. And we're really quick to want to like do something about it or fix it or I don't know change it or all that we want to like react to it. But I will say a large part of grieving is really giving ourselves permission to feel and be with our experience. And I think that's something that we can lose. There's this loss of presence in our lives, right? Where we don't let ourselves really be with our experience and our bodies, our emotions. I mean, we're really experiencing things all the time, but how many of us are really slowing down to just take the time to notice, right? And so, I think a big piece of the grieving process is really honoring what our bodies are communicating to us, which, when we're experiencing the loss of something, our bodies are telling us, hey, like, I need you to slow down. Like, hey, I can't do that right now, right? Hey, I'm overwhelmed here. I'm feeling so sad, or I'm feeling so angry, or I'm feeling so confused, right? That we give that the grief space. We hold space for it. We cry if we need to, and being able to put n a name even on what we're experiencing can be really can offer a lot of relief, because I know I've experienced it where when I'm feeling grief, it just there's all this you can feel the pain in your body, whether it be like in your gut, or you can feel that tightness in your stomach, or just in your heart, right? That there is this even physical sensation of grief, but just even noticing that. And then giving voice to it. I think the research shows time and time again that when we give voice and even name our experiences, there's something that shifts inside of us, that it almost feels like it gets released. And I think when we grieve, it's so important to be able to share that experience and to, be held by somebody else too. And again, I think this is the relational piece, that sometimes our grieving can be even extended because we're not experiencing the connection that we're actually needing during those seasons. And I think it's really I think it's being held, it's being heard, and just being with. I know that sounds so simple, but not.
I mean, presence is so important, and I think that's why there's such a push for mindfulness and but really physical presence too, and that can be really hard during this pandemic.
Totally. I mean, gosh, this grief is unending. Literally.
It just keeps coming at us, honestly.
Yeah, we think it can't get worse, and then it just got worse. We're like, oh, 2021, it's not that hard to be a little better, right? But it got worse real fast.
Yeah, it's crazy what this everything is going on. So, oh, but anyways.
Yeah, we can hold that grief, for another time.
I'm curious about the word authentic. What does that mean, and how is it maybe different than vulnerability or from oversharing, transparency, things like that?
I think that's a really good question. When I don't, I used to, that word, I think, I used to use it so much that it almost started losing its meaning, so I kind of felt a physical sensation in my body just hearing the word authenticity, right? It's like, what does that even mean? But I mean, I think for me, when I think about authenticity, really, I think just kind of what comes up for me is, does what's happening on the inside match what's showing up on the outside? And is there, alignment between just your mind, your body, and your soul, right? And so it's kind of like I feel like a lot of time people confuse it with, like what you said, just oversharing, right? I'm trying to be authentic, so I'm just gonna share it all. Right? But I think it's important to ask, like, what's driving that sharing? Again, authenticity, like, you have to check in with it. You have to be really aware of what's going on in your inner self to know what's going to feel authentic or aligned to what's happening on the inside. And I think a lot of times, sometimes we can end up oversharing because we think, oh, it's about being just completely honest or open about everything, even though I'm feeling super uncomfortable about sharing, this, all this stuff, and then sometimes even when we show up in that way, that can make other people uncomfortable too, right? Because they can feel our discomfort. And then it just kind of creates this really uncomfortable experience for everybody involved. So I think it's not just sharing everything, although I think sometimes for some people that can be the case, right? Depending on what's happening on the inside, that being able to share openly and boldly about things is authentic. But I don't feel like we can just say that's what it is, right? It's just different for different people. And then vulnerability too. I don't think it's just being vulnerable anywhere, any place, that's authenticity. But again, it's you being able to attune to how you're experiencing your current environment, right? And asking, is this safe for me to be vulnerable here? Do I trust this person with myself or with disclosing this part of me? And if the answer is yes, then yes, then that vulnerability is authentic. But sometimes we can really do we can really I guess just disown ourselves or disconnect with ourselves in our vulnerability, because we can end up being vulnerable when really it's not a safe environment, and it doesn't feel right. It actually leaves us feeling really horrible about ourselves. And I think that gives us some clues about whether we are being authentic or not.
Yeah, that makes sense a lot. And I think transparency and kind of sharing it all is not the same thing as being authentic. And I think we kind of get that mixed up sometimes.
And I think a big piece of it, there is this big piece of honesty with yourself, but it doesn't mean you have to be like putting everything out there, but I just being really mindful of what you feel comfortable with putting out there for people to know. Yeah, and some people I think will think, oh, you're not being authentic, right? Some people might accuse somebody because they're just not sharing everything or being open about everything, right? But I think that's not fair, right? That sometimes if someone's not sharing everything with you or being completely honest, I mean, that might give you some information about how they might be experiencing, but also how they're experiencing you, right? Or how they're experiencing the environment. And it may not always be personal to us either. It definitely can be influenced by their own unique stories and lived experiences, but it gives us information, right? And I think that we can still honor how people show up and trust that in their own time that they'll be able to show more of themselves.
Yeah, that's so beautifully said and thoughtful, and I appreciate your answer. I'm curious, on a lighter note, what are your favorite foods?
I love a lot of foods, but I love Asian food.
Yay!
I feel biased, but yeah, I love Korean food. I love Thai food. I love Chinese food. I love boba milk tea, and I love eating, and I love sweets. I love it all. I love food, so
Yes, me
I could go
too.
on and on. Yeah, what are yours?
Oh gosh, my favorites right now. I really like nachos right now.
Oh yes, I do love
Yes,
nachos.
they're so good. And I really
Yeah.
like rice noodles right now is my kick.
Oh, what kind of rice noodles?
Brown rice noodles are really good to me.
Yeah, I yes, I'm total. Yeah, I love noodles.
Yes, noodles
I could
are
eat a lot of
pasta,
it.
just
Right.
anything. So,
Yes,
yes.
yes.
Oh, I also, yeah, I could go on and on, but I won't bore everyone with
Yeah. I love that. Yeah, food, you
And
can talk about food forever.
honestly, it's so life-giving and nourishing, so it's great.
I
Oh my goodness.
know, right?
And one question I ask all my listeners at the end, wrapping up, is pretty open-ended, but I'm curious, how are you becoming?
I feel like just that question it's been kind of shifting for me, and because I will say for a lot of my life it's been always about becoming, you know, like having to become more than I am. And I think in recent days I it's kind of the it's been shifting, and I think the question I've been asking is like, how am I being more, you know? Because I feel like for me in the past, at least for me, when I think about becoming, it's always been like it's always been associated with the sense of striving, right? To be something not. And I think just recently, I don't know what it was, you know, I think there's just been a lot of silence and solitude and social distancing, right? Where I'm with myself a lot. And I think the question that I've been asking more of is like, how can I be more, you know? And how can I be more in touch with myself? How can I be who I actually am, without giving into the pressures of my environment or what I think people need or want from me? And how can I be in a way that nourishes me and brings me joy? And I think a practical way that I've been being more is just, you know, I'm thinking just even on the social media faith, you know, space, giving myself permission to not be on it all the time, right? Or just even not feeling pressured to have to post all the time, or not feeling like I have to be up to date, but just giving myself permission to rest. And I think that's been a really practical way for me to be more, is to just rest, because I think when I rest, I connect with myself the most. And so, yeah.
Oh, I love that answer a lot. And I think it's really getting me thinking too. And so I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for coming on. I'm so grateful for your time.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It was really an honor to be invited to be on your guest.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yay. Okay.